Okay. Well, for the record, then, we'll show that this is the first meeting of the Conference Committee on House Bill 2244. Both House and Senate conferees are present, and they're opened up for discussion.
2254.
2254. What did I say?
45.
I always get it back. Okay. 54. What we'd like to do is to find out first what the difficulties on the House side in the amendments that the Senate made. What is the difficulties and what we have to do with
I think probably we ought to define the changes that were made from the Senate side to prepare.
Okay. I think we're pretty well aware of them.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm interested in two areas of it, and one of them, of course, is the automated facilities. It comes as no surprise to the other I want to take some look at is the matter of the concentration of the superintendent's bank. I think that was just a change from the House version.
You don't see it not
the from the minority report, but
it wasn't changed from the majority report.
No, but the minority report became the majority report.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Yes, it does.
Well, if it had not been, if you will agree that it's not changed from the way it came over from the House, I wouldn't defend it.
I've been wanting to get with the majority all session, and I haven't been able to. I thought maybe this would be changed. So I know what we're talking about. Then the only two areas of concern are the automated facilities that you talk about and the compensation idea of the superintendent.
Now
there's a point on the Asian bank thing that bill passed, Senate Bill 431. The people interested in it contacted me, and I suggested we leave it in the code. I don't think it makes any difference, but I feel it passes supersedes anyway, and I don't see any reason to work it out.
I assume that I have no way of knowing what the government is going to find for it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
No.
I don't
think it comes out the same way, I believe, doesn't it?
I wonder, then, if those are the only two areas, then, that actually that these people are concerned on.
That's my concern. I don't know about Glenn. I have not sat down and discussed this.
That was a problem.
What do you want to do with it?
Of course, mine is a problem. His own salary.
Is what?
The U Bank was his problem. I just can't understand it. He's setting his own salary. That's what we're talking about.
You mean the banking board setting this out, and they signed this out.
How many examiners was it in that?
17.
17 examiners and
the 17 examiners and the superintendent make 18 out of the other.
Jack, do you know what section that's becoming?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And in a conference committee, so that I'm
right.
In a conference committee, so that I am sure that I'm on the right ground. The only areas that we can take up really are those that we're in conflict, or would there be other areas that we would be have a right to look at?
Well, I think we could make an introduced amendment, perhaps, as to the question of the areas if we're inclined to do that.
Yeah, I think the rules say the areas in conflict. Do they not?
I think. I've had quite a bit of problems in this bill since it's come out in regard to the amount of interest rates that can be set. And I did call Mr. Bowen of the bank examiners on that, and I was interested in either dollars and cents that was involved for the general public. The consumer, rather than worrying about the bank. And from his response to me, it isn't a great amount, but I think it was around $100,000.
I think it could be a high. It's hard to measure without going to count more because you can't do it for an
income. I had that conversation with Mr. Olin today, and he explained to me that it's a very difficult thing to really do anything with because of the graduated scales and the amounts of the loans in any particular area that fluctuate from $1 value to another.
Well, this issue is going to come up. So maybe we better talk about that and get to that.
I think it would be fine. I think that's on page 96 of it. Section 173 shows on 96 that part of it which has been taken out, and that part remains. The reason I'm really concerned about this is, I unless something is very definite on it, Joe, I think we've got problems with passing code, even after maybe we make agreement on something else, and I just want to be sure that we're on the right kind of footing on it.
Well, let me, if I may, speak to each of the changes that were made. General changes that were made. In 1953, what we call the 8610 rule was passed. And there was 8510 then, later on was raised to 8610. But what it meant was on the first $500, you could charge $8 a hundred on installment loans. And on the second $500, you could charge $6 a hundred. And on anything above that, you could charge 10% simple. So you had a kind of an apple and a horse concept in that thing, but that's the way it was. Now, there was another section in that code, in the present-day code, that said where loans are not in approximate equal installments, the interest rate would be 10%. And that was made to capture a balloon payment loans that you'd have through a contract or whatever. So they failed to take into account that the majority of the loans that are made in banks are made in the simple interest section, that is commercial loans to business folks or individuals or whatever. So it's then, and primarily corporations. And so we then had a conflict in the usury code, which says that you can loan maximum 10% to people and 12% to corporations. So when we changed that this time, we brought that concept into play, and that's the first change here, that's the 10 and 12% concept. Now, on going back to the 8610 bank, the banks, particularly the larger banks, that now have computer capacity and are now faced with truth in lending, which is the disclosure of the true interest rate. They have the APR concept, which is the annual percentage rate, and it's disclosure. And that's a complicated thing to talk about. We were talking about formulas that an MIT graduate had a tough time covering. So they would like to have the alternate, the approximate equivalent rate. So when the credit card concept, conflict, whatever, came up in 1997, there was a lot of testimony before both houses, and as a result of it came an opinion from the AG that said in just that little area that's circled there, or the bracket, that said in essence that the 6 is approximately 12 and an 8 discount is approximately 16. And that embraces the theory that when you borrow on an installment plan, that you have all your money half the time, and hence you can effectively double the interest rate. Now that isn't precisely accurate actuarially. But now when we go to this table, and you can see what happens with a 6% and an 8% rate, if you follow down the column for 6 or 8%, well, you will find that, let's take the 6%, that for instance, 12 months, the rate is 11.8. Well, that isn't 12%. 11.8, and then if it drifts on out to 48 months, it's 11.76, and so on. And the longer you go, the more closely it gets to 12%, but it will never quite make it. And now, how in the deuce are you going to define that in a code? So, hence, the committee thought, let's just put the upper bracket on it at 12% for the 6 as a maximum alternative, and at 16% for the 8. Okay. Now, that yeah. also...
In order to get to an exact 12, then you would have to have a fractionalized rate.
Right. Now, I think in practice what will happen is bankers that go to the alternate rate, they don't always use the top bracket. And they may say, well, we're not going to charge 12, we're going to charge 11. And that happens, they may charge 15 or 14 or whatever. Now, when we get into the area of credit cards, there was this battle in 67, and there were some things the bill threatened and went on, but it never occurred. But the banks backed off and said, we'll charge 15, and then here the oil companies and so on charging 18. So now, under this code, it brought in another concept down here called the periodic rate, and there we are dividing these totals by the number of periods, 12, 15, 18, 22, whatever it is, you get that periodic rate. But they will be using the 16% on the first 500, or less if they choose, and 12% on the next 500. So when you put a 12 and a 16 together, and you get a 28, you're going to come up with an average of 14 if your loan should average. Now, in credit cards, you don't know precisely what the yield is, but we know that it's less than it will show here, because a good share of the business that they write with credit cards doesn't go into the credit solvent. People pay their bills within the 30-day period, and I take care of that. So I think the net result of this will be, as banks have a desire to keep their loan totals high rather than low, because their acquisition cost is less for a bigger loan than it would be for a multitude of little loans, they will be sliding upwards in the higher bracket of loans, which will pull the rate down, and it could be substantially lower than they presently do now at 15, because the average is 2. So that's the change there. Now, another change that was put in was the $50,000 language. In the last legislature, the Mortgage Bankers Association introduced a bill to take out from the Section 82 on interest the defensive users for loans that were over $50,000. And they failed to amend one of the preamble to Section 82, which said that you may charge 10 people and 12 corporations. And there was a bill introduced, Bill 4488 this time, which went through both houses and passed and before the governor's decision to amend that. At the same time this bill was before the session last time, they failed to look at the cross-references, which said in the banking code, notwithstanding Section 82, the rates will be. And they missed it there. So it was therefore put into this code as a housekeeping measure to conform Section 82 in the banking code, so that there is no difference in that. That's the sum and substance of that one of the sections.
That was the $200,000, and you indicated that was about as far as you could come.
Well, I was guessing a little bit, because I'd have to look at 450 banks, but it takes $3.5 billion in loans, and they probably have something like 23 or 4 in a million, let's say, U.S., and maybe a little more per capita in their credit cards, and that's 30 or 40 million that they have in direct over-the-counter, well, they have more than that in consumer loans, but in direct over-the-counter loans. The bulk of the loans that the larger banks are taking are by some dealers. So when you take all that into consideration, like we're looking at maybe 200, 300, or 400, if we're looking at $600,000 of income, if you divide that by 3.5 billion, it goes 0.0001 and a fraction. So it's so infinitesimal, there's nothing. But this appeared to us to be a simple way to put the code in a language that the layman could understand it. That's why we did it. And then the cure of this computer problem was well, it's a simple answer. That was a committee's whole consideration. And it wasn't the original one. So I don't think that's another thing.
the discussion of this problem come up in presentation in the floor in the Senate, and it did not in the House.
But it's been discussed widely now.
Well, I talked to Senator Roberts about it this morning, and told him that we wouldn't be able to do it this way.
Okay, well,
I'll
just say that I don't have any more.
All right, just for purposes of clarification, if you roll back all of these 1 point, what would the effect be?
You need to roll the 12 back to 11
mm-hmm.
and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, it would be it would actually cut the interest rate in many cases.
What would be the what would be the dollar impact?
Well, we were looking at roughly 0.5% would generate $200,000 to $400,000. 1 point would be cut to around probably $800,000 to $700,000. That's not a precise answer. There would have to be a lot of contacting some other things. If you look at the chart, you can see what it do, because you could take a 6%, let's say 24 months, because that's a pretty good average for a personal type loan, where the yield is 11.52. If we were to lock that down to 10 something, we would be going down to about a 5.5 to 5.25% add on in effect, and we would be cutting the present rate.
Now, as I understand it, this would allow banks to increase from 15 to 16 their credit card charge.
Yes. No. They're not allowed anything right at the moment. They're going along with the present code that doesn't define credit cards. It doesn't even speak to periodic rate.
They're going because of the lawsuit that was brought.
Right. So possibly the lawsuit and the threat of legislation and so on, that's the rate that they adopted.
All right,
now this basically, I think, puts it in the same ballpark because of the 16% and the 12% being 28% total divided by 2, and you're going to come up with 14. Now, to come up with a precise answer, you have to know what their average outstanding is, and you have to know what their actual outstanding is with dollars. It would take a lot of competition, but I think it would come out about the same as the present is, because that's what they concluded when they went into it.
Let me get to my question then, finally. What would the objection be to providing that on credit cards they charge 15?
I don't think there would be too much objection from them, but I think the banks that use these ought to speak to that question. But
well, I'd be happy
my impression is it would probably raise the rate for the consumer, because I think this will effectively lower the rate.
The point is this, Jack. Now, there's widespread discussion that this is a boondoggle for the banks, and it's going to take some in-depth now discussion with these people to point out to them that it's a minute charge, and it's done for purposes of simplicity, and maybe the banks won't use it, and I don't think they're going to buy that. I think if we maybe this method of providing it on credit cards, which I don't think they're going to use it anyway, the 15%. I mean, if there was a way to divide by amendment that they were charging only 15, which they're charging now, I think it would help us in debating the question.
This is basically, you don't have the benefit of the whole thing. I just gave you an excerpt from the thing that's about 12 pages long. But that's basically how they arrived at the 15 to 4 was coming up with this the average of the 16 and the 12. That's how they came up with the 15, on what the effective yield would be.
When the time comes, I want to ask the banking representative.
Go ahead. There's some experts there that can ask you precisely, probably.
I point.
Why don't you come up to the chair's own direction?
First of all, as I understand it, you are complying with the purposes of the lawsuit, charging 15% on credit cards.
On the 3500.
On the 3500. All right. Is it possible, or is it objectionable to you, or either, that kind of language be inserted in this bill?
Well, Senator, I really can't answer that question right now. I guess I'm completely ignorant because I really didn't. I was not aware until right now that the section also applied to credit cards. I thought that my understanding is the credit card section merely codified the same general opinion. I didn't realize.
That's something that I would like to research, gentlemen.
I can check it out.
I think we have to have it.
I don't suppose it affects the independent banks very much because they don't have any credit cards, so I won't ask them about it.
Is the
U.S. or the first national bank representative here? If they're not interested in the bill.
We can perhaps get their interest, Senator.
Yeah, I'm sure he's probably have already. I haven't talked to you gentlemen about it, but
yeah.
If we get some information, I think we'll discuss it.
Tomorrow?
Why are they just discussing it?
We'd like to have a. Maybe we'll put the question you want to ask. On the two areas of disagreement, what is your people suggesting?
Well, which one do you want to take first?
Either one you want to.
Randy,
take automated facilities. That's
okay.
What you're talking about.
All right, that's what I'm talking about. My understanding, Mr. Chairman, that there's been substantial negotiation going on between the various parties that are interested in this matter, and that there has been perhaps a pretty good area of compromise in connection with it. And without committing anyone to any compromise that I might suggest, I would just point out what I understand is acceptable to at least a portion of the people who initially were opposed to any extension of the automated facility situation. My understanding of that is that automated facilities should be allowed during the next 2-year period at the rate of not more than 4 such units for any one bank, and each should be succeeding 2 years, 74 and 75. Without a limitation as to the off-site distances, but certainly subject to the same rules and regulations that were contemplated in the minority report of the bill that came over from the House, and that they'd be assuring of public necessity and convenience. I don't know whether at the moment I'm free to represent that anyone is really locked to that position. I understood it was an area of at least tentative or perhaps possible agreement.
It's different.
Okay. Vern?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, yeah. Our position is to be. I'm not speaking to independent banks.
In the banking division?
Yes, the banking division. Our concern is the minority report is now on the legal aspect. reading to necessity and the concept that throws it right back into the lawsuit, which is then adjudicated, and which is under appeal. But until we feel it, we resolve the appeal, we don't conclude this is where we are, other than to accept that budget. That we would have to contest on nearly every application that came in. And the judge said also that there must be, and there is a concept countrywide, that there is to be duality in national state banks. And at any time you have a superintendent that has to interpret, or a controller that has to interpret, whatever they do, they're wrong. It just throws back into an area of controversy. So, the discharge, in effect, of the legislature was, legislature, you decide this issue and make the parameters so definitive that no one has to define it. And that's what the revision committee attempted to do, and I think they did do, in their code that said 100 yards. And then it comes down to the committee, I suppose, or the legislature to decide is 100 yard right. And with that concept that I'm holding the top three personally.
Now, that do you understand a lot of the legislature provided to be located within 200 miles where it has to be satisfied if you put stands on?
Yes. Or if it's on the or 10 feet in the air, or whatever.
Whatever the legislature wanted to
do. Right. Because that's their prerogative. So that's the way we left that opinion. Now,
don't you have the same language on branches, however?
Yes, there is the language on branches, your convenience and advantage, but they all mean the same thing, necessity or need, or whatever you want to call it. And that is always subject to contest. We do have a contest once in a while, and we raise the question, or the independent banks will raise the question with the larger banks, but. And sometimes they prevail, sometimes they don't. But it's a rather rare occasion. It just doesn't happen very often. And this one, I'm certain it will on every occasion until they feel it's enough.
So all banks that you.
Right. So that's basically the issue. So on the competitive side of it, which is the independent bank's position, they would like to stick to this code as it was written. And of course, the argument on the other side is that. We come up against lawful inequality and the burden of the amendment that was proposed on the Senate with a large number of units without restrictions was equally available to any institution, any bank. And I also know that 16 of our have capital that is less than the total dollar cost of these units. So obviously they can't compete and they're breaking good. But in some places in that area, they rely.
But I am correct, Jack, and I think it's stating at least some segment of the independent banking industry was tentatively in agreement, or are you aware of the proposal that I was put forth?
Well, the proposal that you put forth, I don't think accurately describes their interest in compromise, or even in any compromise, because you spoke, I think, of the minority report. It's the minority report that we object to, meaning it's community necessity fund.
Right.
And then you spoke, I think, of four units at least for the next 2 years, I suppose by the time of the word, so we have that and
well, what you understand well, further study
well, the area that I think that we're amenable to is 4 units, period, beyond the parameters of that 100 yards concept. And there's some other language that I have in my mind that I've adopted, frankly, from their report, which is paragraph 2, which means that these things are strictly units. Branches and that sort of thing, and then an area that I adopted from the controller's opinion in his report that these units not be manned by people accept the service of the testing facility, the arm of it, to put money that you take records out of it, not put it. And it's better over there. I don't think it's that bad. The four-unit concept is one that is a threat to the whole banking industry, state or national. From the federal home loan bank, really, the four units per institution. It is a ruling, it is a law, I guess it's hard to ask that the law, but it is a ruling with men, and when you're back in the day, and you're basically saying, separate. Could be, can leave with our code. It's adopted.
With the wild card.
With the wild card.
Do you want to answer that if that's what I'm saying?
Well, of course, as I mentioned before, is that our position is always different to the language in our report. So if we can, if the language in there is acceptable to the superintendent, and the goal for four units is 74 and 40 units is 75, we put this out of that. I think we had discussions on this thing, and the judge mentioned here that the superintendent could rule in the event the award is changed by the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and secondly, if it could be changed in the session of the legislature. However, and this is either one of those things that is very possible. However, we would prefer to see the four in the 1975 if it was a contingency that the nothing does happen, and we are basically a competitive purchase in the state of Florida. There's another thought that may tag it on to your remarks. It means that the SNL is presently doing nothing. The state, and the appropriation department, the IT division, hasn't yet adopted the federal ruling and haven't adopted primary legal pressure. And I know of no SNLs yet that have put in money machines. And I frankly don't anticipate that they're going to do a heck of a lot until they put in the third party payment system, meaning checking or some adjunct to it. And in any case, when that pressure comes, we put the bill out just as it is. When that comes, the pressure will be on my back, like you wouldn't believe, to do something. And if we adopt any kind of an amendment or a compromise, whatever, when that form of competition presents itself, we additionally will have the pressure to, for instance, if they put in four units this year, and they attempted to say they have no, and attempted to do it in, or did it in 75 or 74, whenever it might happen, well, the banks would be after the institution. So we give us the heavy power. Right now, the pressure is there. The bill in the wild card, I can use it.
You mentioned the discussion with the Attorney General's office in objection to the language. To your knowledge, has he prepared anything that could be suitable or acceptable to the same outside the 100 yards?
No, the only question I presented to him, what would be the effect of the minority report on me and on the department and on our court? And he came up with a letter that they passed out. He basically said he'd be coming right back in the confines of that lawsuit. You might have one lawsuit, you might have 20 or 8 or 4 or whatever. And when I say one, it's possible that I bring up the question before the judge, and then he comes up with some other kind of decision. So we don't have to take each one. When you get to convenience and necessity, I haven't been able to self-find anybody to completely define it. Because there's no parameters, it's just a word. It's out here, and everybody uses it, but they don't know quite why.
It would seem like it would give the administrator quite a lot of discretion in the determination.
Oh, it's wild and hard too. But the judge said these things are convenient and effective. He didn't. I don't want to argue that point, but that's what he said, and I'm stuck with it.
Okay. question.
System, and it's the only one in the state. Why should they have a special deal setting their own salaries and compensation? It isn't done anywhere else in the state that I know of. There must have been some odd reason why it was put in there, which I don't know.
This is a survey that we made, turn past the first page for the moment. This is a survey that we prepared last year, in our salaries before the executive department. And it was prepared by my division in conjunction with our board. And in the first column, it shows the various salaries on an annualized basis and on a monthly basis for various examiners and superintendents and so on. And then it shows what comparable salaries were then with the FDIC with whom we worked on a day-to-day basis, and with Bank A and Bank B, which are two large banks from whom we get our people, and then the seven states with which we compete on a basis of responsibility. That is, they have similar power, similar size, and things like that. Now, from this, we then struck an average, which is the second column, and in examiner one, for instance, it was a 15% increase would bring it up to the average. The superintendent's salary would be a 47% increase to bring it up to the average. Now, these salaries were adopted by the board and presented to my boss, Mr. Lieberman, who in turn passed them on to the executive division, and to which there was a response finally given the next January, which was the response of no action. Now, what we're really faced with is this. We have had no turnover in our department of any size or any magnitude, except in some areas. And that is not a plus factor. For instance, in the last 10 years, we've lost 14 people, one died, and that was last year. He was our senior examiner, who was the trust examiner, and I can't replace him. I just can't deal with the salary structure that we have, which is 14,000. It takes about 20,000 to get a man that's skilled in trust work, particularly in that area, and who would be a competent fellow in examination. We lost the three from retirement, which was no consequence. We asked four to leave because of incompetence. We had three left for money alone, two left for money and travel, and the travel contract is not too much of an argument. That's just something you have to put up with in this business where they're gone 60% of the time, but it does narrow down the field from where you get people. And one left for travel alone. Now, what it spells is that we end up with a department that is staffed by people who neither command the respect of the bankers, to whom they have to stand up to, particularly some of the strong characters, or people of strong character, and that you don't have the confidence in examination. Now, I know from looking at the federalities, the National Bank Examiners, that the U.S. Bank has a good number of people in that area. Their last president was a National Bank Examiner, and one or two of their senior area people are National Bank Examiners. And they're well trained, and they're well paid. And they stay until some bank takes them off. the greatest compliment the state can have, and particularly our department, would be that people are turning through there to go to demand. But they are not. They're not in demand. And when I go out to recruit, our recruitment is limited to this salary program, and I get today. Well, I got a list of 15 to replace this one guy that quit last week, and five of them were drunk. One of them, well, this is probably un-American.
He probably did not.
No, I don't know if he is. You have to turn the tape off on this one. He was something that most men couldn't be. And at any rate, I just couldn't find anybody on there that I really want to hire and turn out to protect your money. And that's basically my problem. We're not attracting the people to get the salary to thing up, and we're not getting it up. And I know this is a statewide problem. We're not unique, but we do have to recruit from the bank. We can't recruit from any other industry. And we don't have the dollars or the time to train, and we have a department where the banks are growing so fast that we've got to do something about it. We're shorthanded now and doing our job, and I would just fall in my tracks if we had some failures. I don't know what I would do with my division. I couldn't handle it right now. I'd have to go out and recruit.
Glenn, I have the same experience that you have. I tell you, the only thing that really brought me around was that, one, there's a standard percentage, I think it's 150th of 1%, that the state charges all banks that they expand. And that percentage is a standard percentage that is not going to be changed because, of course, these banks are growing, and as they grow, the assets grow, and therefore they get more money. They've got a $300,000 surplus in that account, and will continue to have that kind of a surplus, which will mean that they're not going to endanger the taxpayers or the interest rate for the consumer in any way. It's the money that the banks put up, and the banks that are being charged for this money are in agreement with this kind of a provision. So it seemed to me that, you know, if they want it, they're paying for the service. If they want it, and they can get better people to make these examinations because of that amendment, then I can see no reason to object to it, other than the question of, and there was one or two brought up, you know, what about the conflict of the banking board setting the superintendent's salary and the examiner's salary? I mean, would there be an opportunity for collusion? That was my next question.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the banking board now selects the examiner, and they select the superintendent. So if there was collusion after this, there's collusion now. Because they make the selection. They're not appointed by anybody else.
So that, excuse me, they are, they're, the list of applicants comes from the board. But the director of commerce makes the decision
the superintendent.
Of the superintendent with a ratification.
But not the examiner.
No, the examiners I collect.
Are selected.
Yes.
By the
but they're selected through a list of recruitment that comes from the executive department.
Okay, the superintendent confirmed to maybe show the action.
No. But there's one kind of a big criminal penalty that's laid right out there if there's any hanky panky.
Really hang on to it. If we make a distinction, are we quite ahead that other departments aren't going to request their immediate supervisors to make
arguments to
set their dollars?
It's a precedent, but it is, in a way, I look into the question, well, you know, what other agencies of government do this? And there's only one that I can find, and that's the Board of Higher Education. And in that respect, that's a third of all state employees, so it's only one agency, but it means a lot of people.
Well, Well, may I suggest, Mr. Chairman, then, that we get a little input on the other question, and we can perhaps determine them all in one shot here with another meeting. Mm-hmm. If that makes this approval,
yeah. Yeah,
rather than acting peacefully on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I wasn't hung up on this. I just didn't. I can't understand why.
That's a good question.
I understand why. I'm
not
sure I agree yet, but
my
first
impression was the same as yours this morning. Well, let's do that then. If that does that make sure? When do you want to meet then? When you get the information together that you want to submit to us, you let us know. And we'll be here in time.
As soon as they get, I think we should do it as soon as they get the information. So I hope we're not going to be here too many more weeks.
Well, there's one thing. This afternoon, I doubt very much if we can be excused before for a meeting. I think we're going to be kind of hung up there.
We'll be hung up all afternoon, too.
Are you close?
Yeah, we'll be having a meeting tomorrow until 1 o'clock.
About 11.
Well, and if we have to. Maybe we could meet in the morning, you see, or later on this evening. The only thing is that we have to have a clerk handy, and that's the only problem.
Senate meets tomorrow.
Pardon?
Senate meets tomorrow.
Yeah. At least I assume it is. Yeah. Okay. When you get together, let us know.
All right.
Then we'll reach for the meeting. Thank you, gentlemen.
Now, June 30th, 7:30, second meeting of the Banking Code Conferees.
I thought it was, you know, at least a little bit
before the meeting starts.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. I move that on page 97 of the reimbursed bill, on line 14, strike 16 and 50 and a half, and on line 17, strike 12 and insert 11 and a half, and on page 98, Jack, you have the language
after the period, and you'll have to get the proper language from counsel on this. Would assert, and in no case shall the applicable per annum rate exceed 15%.
That's my motion. That gets satisfied.
Yes, that's satisfactory.
Is there any objections to anyone on the committee? Then I report to you show that. Okay, we'll do that.
Make the motion out of you
guys. I'm not sure what the agreement is.
Okay. Four.
Do you have the language? Yes, now the language I have.
Yeah, Gabriel, I have a copy of it.
Yeah, I did.
I had a copy, but forgot very well.
Well,
one copy is enough, Jack.
I'll have to get some more.
But I thought, why don't you read it off what you want, Jack, okay. And see if this.
Okay, I can speak to it.
Let him speak to it.
We use the language in the bill before you, which is the precise language, and we delete paragraph 2B. 326, about 183, 182, 882. 2B says it's not feasible to install the units within the confines of the building. And the question was that presents a decision that somebody has to make. And he's going to decide whether the physiognomy or complexion or whatever the building is permissive. So we strike that, nobody makes a decision on that. And then we add, after the closing language, we add in paragraph 3, it says approval to install and operate does not preclude the installation and operation of automated facilities by other institutions that are near the same location. This is language from the U.S. Bank proposal. Paragraph 4, automated facilities which are off-premise may not be manned by people except as they are stationed in the vicinity of the facility for purposes of providing physical security, instructions to customers or service to the facility. This is the language that was extracted out of the controller's ruling on the approval that he granted on the two banks that the units, the facilities that we with regard to. And this limits him to mechanized activities, not full type of bank. Full type branches come under another paragraph 5 says, if you got it, notwithstanding the provision of this section, the bank upon notice to the superintendent to install 4 automated facilities without the restrictions of paragraphs 1, 2, and 3. And the thought there was, how do you police this thing? And my comments were, well, if the national banks get out of line, the state banks will tell me, and vice versa. But in any case, they would have to just merely notify us that they're putting them in with the tally on it, and the controller is going to be doing it.
This avoids the problem of that you had pointed out and the court had pointed out, it's a matter of determining the...
There's no determination to make other than the count.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the amendment to Section 326, the leading paragraph 2B and adding paragraphs 3, 4, and 5 as contained in the amendment proposed by Mr. Olin.
We've heard the motion. Mr. Gentleman, is there any disagreement in the committee on it? Before we make a motion, is everybody satisfied?
Well, we have one question before us. The mutual savings bank industry suggests that the word, wherever it says banking, the word financial institution be substituted. That was not included in the code. Now, the considerations we have to, that I have to as administrator worry about here, is that there is some question whether or not this activity, the third-party payment and the demand account, demand-type activity. And I don't know the answer to that yet. We've been trying to get a ruling from FDIC which controls this factor. And I didn't.
So didn't you still handle another wild card?
No, because the wild card is that I'd have to get a federal counterpart to lean on to do it. I don't have a quarrel with it at all. It just may be kind of redundant in the opinion, but I told Mr. Bronner that if there is no question when the wild card comes in, I can rule on that subject, and I will rule on it in January. If you want to put financial institutions here, I don't have any real objection. I understand how it's solved.
I'm not moving.
it may involve some correction someplace else, and I don't know where those are. That's
something
done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so then if you will accept that.
Yes, I will.
Is there any objection? Okay, with unanimous approval of it. That's it, that's settled. And we'll get to we'll get to report, ladies and gentlemen. And, and then we'll get over to the sign and we'll get in as soon as we can. And I think what we will try to do is keep from happening to re-engross this bill. I'll talk to Cecil this morning and see if we can use that bill. And if you could probably, one of you help Harriet on that with the amendment.
I'm going to get Janet Merrill down here right away.
Okay, let Janet come down here and do a preparation here for it and get it all ready.
Okay, you want enough to go help.
I prefer that okay. You all four stay here.
Yes.
And I think the draft meeting is the draft.
So just so
everybody understands.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. I'll be here, John, in
the what's your hour of meeting now?
And Harriet will be here
and then you ought to write up a little explanation of what we've done on the interest rate, what we've done on the rebate amendment for
Right. Do you want to talk to any other questions?
We've already passed the rest of the week.
We passed it twice, so
we
understand it correctly.
I don't know if this question should come up, or if it has anything to do with second hand, but someone asked me some weeks ago, what does this code do for the consumer? And I prepared a list of things that it does for the consumer. Most of the code is addressed to the consumer. It's a police thing, it's a detective thing.
Well, that's...
Yeah. So whoever's speaking to this may want to have that on
hand.
I can get more.
Yeah,
this is the only one I have.
Okay.
I did it originally.
Okay.
Is
one of these original?
No.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay,
we'll
let
Bob handle it on the floor.
Is there anything else?
Lawyer
in the floor? Gentlemen, thank you. You've been a very cooperative group to work with, and we will get this together, and hopefully we can get it passed. Hopefully.
This is the mini bottle bill.
Mini bottle bill.
In other words, when the bottle bill was written, it said that only the consumer could get the refund from the bottle or the can that they picked up. And in this bill, it's going to substitute person for consumer, so that the kids that go out here and pick up the bottles, or whoever picked them up, got a right to get the dough out of it. Now that's what that.
Oh boy, I'm all for that. My grandson makes $3 a day.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I was a kid at Seaside a long time ago, I used to pick up beer bottles, particularly after something like the Elks Convention or something, you know. And I did real well. So my dad came in one night with a bunch of councilmen to bring him down from Pasco. Coming up from the train, you know, and I had this wagon of beer bottles, and he was with these gentlemen. I said, "Hello, Pa, look what I got." So I know what they. I sympathize with the kids.
I didn't know the Elks had been organized by the time you were
small.
Good bill is amendments I'd like to make to it.
Yeah.
Where's Hostel 2411?
No.
Well, we got.
Is it drum, man?
That's what we will put out. Now we have one other bill that they've asked about, and I just want to get, we're talking about two bills, and let's go, so I know everybody's good. Number one, today was referred to us the Fish and Game Unification Bill. And there's a lot of incidents from both sides, from executives, and a lot of people really interested in this bill. I feel that we have been asked to do something here too fast for our deliberation anyway, because we got a bill of that immensity, but I have told them that I'm going to give them a good, fair hearing on if we possibly can, so we'll meet with your gentlemen's approval in the morning at 7:30, and we'll have two bills. Judge Lewis is coming down to talk about a child adoption bill. He will be here at 7:30. We will be taking up at 8. I would like to give the proponents and the opponents both on this bill a chance so that we can maybe get a look at what they're talking about anyway. I haven't looked at the bill. I know nothing about the bill. I don't care. I have no interest on either side. But would it be all right with you gentlemen in the morning to have that hearing at 7:30?
We just pick up the merger bill first, because I've already listed it, and I won't have to be here until later.
All right. Well, we only be here 30 minutes anyway.
We won't spend too much time, because Senator Stevens has been asking me to hold a meeting of the Rules Committee concerning that scene of Rules on the smoke. I don't know how much time that will take.
Well, anyway.
Well, I'll be here.
I'll be here, Senator.
Well, that means we'll be here. Now, I hope maybe tonight you will probably get wires and calls in every direction on that reunification bill. I hope you will put your questions together and think what we want to ask.
What does that, Doug?
The gays are making the things to make.
Oh.
And I feel that you get to it here this quick and not giving us time on it and making demands on it, we're asking a little too damn much of this committee. I'll just put it that way. But we will put whatever effort we can and the time we've got to work on it. Now, is that a fair enough way to do it? Or if you got any suggestions, say so.
Well, I'll be here.
Bill for butane and see air pollution.
I just want to see if the members of the committee have seen enough concern with it to want to do something with it at this late date, George.
32.
Does this take
32?
Does
the number.
Does this take the gasoline as exempt from the user tax?
The butane.
In other words, the highway division, then that car that's used on the highway is going to be exempt that?
Yeah.
There's another road.
Well, it's just for small, more than, and the way I understand it. Now, that's
I had a man call me yesterday that had a whole fleet of trucks, and then he was very much interested. He said, talking about $350 each truck, that if he could put that on and not have to pay that highway tax.
Well, I think it's a... The weight mile tax. What is the weight mile tax?
They have to pay fuel tax in addition.
Maybe we better take a look.
Yeah. Let's get.
All the gas company trucks that do is want the rail driver.
So let's take a look at
that. I'll get that in
okay,
the report. I'll report it to you.
Okay. That's about the only thing I know, Jack.
Well, we got a way to move.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I'll be here at 7:30 in the morning. I'll have a hot coffee. And this meeting was called this morning. It's called a special early meeting. And we're privileged to have with us a former colleague of ours, member of the Senate, Jed Lewis, and she is intended to come down and give us some information on House Bill 27 and 97. I think the books are all open to that bill. And Judge Lewis, if you would like to up there, is there any place where you want to sit there?
Oh, that's all right.
We appreciate you taking the time early this morning to do this.
Not all that.
Pardon?
Not all of that.
Senators, I very much appreciate you giving me the
Mr.
chance
Chairman,
to come down here this morning.
Will you swear the witness?
Well, I don't think it's necessary.
I promise I prefer it too, though. Well, I'm going to deviate a little bit this morning from what normally is done in the juvenile court. You normally never mention the name of the child. But in this case, all of these cases have gone up on appeal to the appellate court so that they're all of record. What House Bill 2797 does, and I'm sorry I haven't been here earlier, but I thought it was dead and buried, but it seems to have been revised and is here. It spells out some legislative guidelines to courts in terminating the rights of parents to their children. A gentleman, of all the jobs I've ever done in my life, there's none I hate more than to say to a parent, you are unfit. Existing law provides that a court may terminate if it finds the parents are unfit by reason of conduct or condition
seriously detrimental to style. What does that language mean? We who have to hear these cases are never sure. I have here the case of Tootie, and for our purposes, that's enough of his name. I terminated the rights of Tootie's mother to the child. The Court of Appeals affirmed me, the Supreme Court affirmed me. This mother is a prostitute. She has spent most of her life up in jail. She has dealt in heroin. She has violated her federal probation term. She's done about all the things that are improper. She won't work. She won't see her child. She's been guilty of 18 different convictions. So clearly, when you have a person like that, and if you terminate, our Court of Appeals and our Supreme Court has said, this is conduct or condition seriously detrimental to the child. Then we have another baby, Anna. When Anna was a little tiny child, her folks dumped her off with strangers. Anna lived in foster homes for 5 years. Anna's folks decided to release her for adoption. The adoption hearing was set before me. Anna's parents showed up and said they changed their mind. We don't want that child adopted. Under existing law, of course, I had to deny the adoption. These parents met while they were both patients of therapy. These parents have no ability to care for this child or any child. They are on welfare. They've been on welfare constantly. They have to get requisitions because they can't even make the grant last. They're given money for bus fare to go see the child, but they won't spend the bus money. They get drunk instead. Judge Lennon of our court terminated their rights in a juvenile court proceeding. The Court of Appeals affirmed them. The Supreme Court said, no, the legislature hasn't established any guidelines for this type of conduct. One of the judges in the Supreme Court said the law is unconstitutional. It allows too much leeway to the court. It doesn't spell out what factors must be considered by a judge. So this case came back to the juvenile court. Now the Supreme Court said this doesn't mean you have to return the child, but this isn't enough. This isn't what the legislature had in mind. With that language, unfit by reason of conduct or condition, seriously detrimental to the child. Well, in the meantime, Mama of Anna got pregnant again. And now we have Linda. Linda was found wandering around the street in her diapers in the snow. The parents were drunk. Linda's folks periodically get in a fight and beat each other up. Same parents again. In the middle of the hearing on Linda, the parents came in and said, we want to release Anna for adoption. So we talked to their parents and their foster parents, and it was agreed that this is what they wanted to do. Anna's now adopted. After all this week through the court, Anna's now what they tried to do 6 years ago. But meanwhile, we have Linda. Linda will soon be 7 years of age. The conduct of the parents is exactly what they did with Anna. And yet, under this existing language, I seriously doubt if I can terminate their rights as parents. The last time they were before me, about a year ago, we spelled out in detail, you must visit once a month, we'll provide you with funds to see the child, we'll try to help you get a job, we'll try to see that you have enough food stamps, we'll try to see that all these things happen for you. They cash their welfare check and go to Bremen. They spend their bus fare money on hitchhiking. They go to see the child and take her hitchhiking. Now, what this House bill does is try to set out some of the kinds of things that socially parents shouldn't do. Maybe it isn't in the language that Tom and I would use as lawyers, but it does give the court some hope. It spells out, you'll notice on page 2, that the parents are unfit by reason of conduct or condition seriously detrimental to the child, and integration of the child into the home of the parent is improbable in the foreseeable future, due to a pattern not likely to change. And then you give us some guidelines. In determining such conduct, the court shall consider that it is not limited to one or more of the following, and you spelled out there. There is also a change in the provisions with regard to desertion. existing law says we may terminate if the parent has willfully deserted or failed to provide. This doesn't mean that a poor person who can't support his kids is going to lose them. Heaven forbid, that couldn't happen. But a person who can and won't deliberately, willfully, intentionally abandon the child. You'll notice on page 3 of the bill, subsection 4, the rights of the parent or parents may be terminated if the court finds the parent or parents have abandoned the child. We've had babies left in our county beside the road. We haven't known where the parents were. Babies have been left in churches. How can you prove willful desertion? Because you don't know what the parents feel. Well, here clearly you give us some authority, some legislative guidelines on abandonment. Now, I know it sounds funny for a judge to come to the legislature and say, tell us how to start. But this is an effect that I'm doing. Our appellate court has said this language is so broad, and there's a question as to its existing constitutionality, it leaves the public uncertain as to the conduct it prohibits. It leaves judges free to decide, without any legally fixed standards, what is prohibited and what is not. Now, this bill attempts to give legislative guidelines to judges as to the type of conduct that we may consider before we ever terminate the rights of the child. Interestingly enough, the Oregon State Juvenile Court judges and directors met last January. While they did not like the new code because of certain procedural aspects, they unanimously supported the termination provisions of the code which were embodied in this bill. And I'll be glad to try to answer any questions. I know you have a lot of business.
Senator Mahoney.
Judge, I hate to see you bring this bill before us. I don't know of any judge in Multnomah County, he's having a task, so I've never had a point of view. Your ability, your great soul, your sincerity, I've served with you. I practiced law for many years before you, but I don't like this bill. I'm mindful of a statement made by Congressman Green the other day in the papers. He said a wise and great leader said, considering laws, they must consider not the benefit which flow if the law is properly administered, but the very evil harm that's improperly administered. I wouldn't be afraid to have you do this part. I'm being very frank with you. Just as you are, if I appear before you,
you're always frank, Tom.
Because you served down here, too. I take, for instance, in line 27, habitual use of intoxicating liquor. Or narcotics. Now, if we passed against my opposition the other day a bill practically blessing anybody that's caught, they're not more than 1 ounce of heroin, or not heroin, but narcotics that these, hey, all right. Now, suppose that a person were using that stuff for a year, they'd lose his trial. Suppose there are habitual use of intoxicating liquor. By many, I don't drink, I don't know, but many people habitually use intoxicating liquor all their lives. That doesn't harm them, they're having a child. Now, I wouldn't be afraid to have you use this power, but I know some judges in Multnomah County I wouldn't want to give up. I just think how awful it is to take and say, this child that God gave you, you're no longer a player. I can't see it.
Tom, I lived with kids who for 7 years are in foster care because the only existing language we have is parents are unfit by reason of conduct.
Yeah, you use extreme cases.
These are the only kinds, Tom, that we ever terminate. I don't suppose in 12 years in the family, I've terminated more than five.
The others can go for it. I can't conscientiously do it. To me, the most awful thing in the world, and God knows I love little children, I have grandchildren. May I be a great grandfather, so I don't know. But to terminate, just cut off finally at all, I can't.
Tom, you have to read that section in connection with subsection 2, which provides the parents are unfit by reason of conduct or condition seriously spelled out, and integration of the child into the home is improbable in the foreseeable future. All right, suppose we have a parent that is habitually drunk. The child is a parent. The child is integrated into that family unit. So father gets dead drunk every night, but there is a home. The child is in the home and is thriving in the home. There is no way in God's world that a parent twice could be terminated under those conditions.
Don't disturb the temporary custody. Okay, fair enough. But these social workers, this came from social workers, didn't it?
Yes, it
did. Okay, but cut off forever. What's the necessity for?
Tom, there are kids who have spent 10, 15 years in foster care. Every social agency, every court worker works and works and works with these parents to get them to see parents.
There are some, yes.
And these are the kinds of cases
I ran into them personally.
Now,
I have.
Under a recent Supreme Court decision, you have to appoint counsel for a parent before you terminate. And this is right, because this is a terrible step. I don't want to go home and cry whenever I hear one of these things. They just tear your guts out. But you have to face the situation. Are you condemning a child to a life of this foster home, that foster home, another foster home, never belonging, because parents can't or won't meet their responsibilities?
Well, why is it necessary to enter a final permanent order?
Because you have a kid dangling during all of his majority. Little Petey here would have been in one foster home after another. He never spent a life with his mother. He was born while she was in jail.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that the important thing to think about here is the child itself, and the child that's going to grow up under a situation where he's moved from one foster home to another, sooner or later is going to develop emotional problems that will be almost irreparable. While on the other hand, if a judge can terminate that parental, whatever it is, and put that child in an adopted home where he's loved and cared for, the kid's got a chance then to become a solid citizen and grow up to with opportunity. And I, for a long time, I felt that these people are too soft on terminating. Another thing about it, I believe that if there are a few terminations, it may kick some of these parents back into responsibility.
Then what?
Well, then by golly, they can rear their children.
No, they've lost.
Well, I'm talking about, yeah. It's like the guy you hang. You hang the guy in order to set an example for those who may.
Well, how many people other than those kind of know about those things? Them, us.
Well, if they know that they're.
You and I, Judge Lewis has handled hundreds.
I'll tell you how they know.
I've handled many of them myself, an attorney on both sides. Man.
Well, I know you have, Tom, but the point is that you've been operating under the old law. And I'll tell you a story about that someday. But if there were a few at termination, why, you as an attorney would advise your clients, you know, you better shape up or that Judge Lewis will take your kids away from you. That's how they find it out. And I don't know, I think it's tragic to let kids grow up, and that's what they do, they just grow up, they're not ready.
Well, we have authority to terminate now, but in view of the Supreme Court's decision in the McMaster case, as to the broad lack of legislative guidelines, this bill puts guidelines on the court. It tells us under what conditions we can. Now we have authority to terminate. It's nothing new, Tom. We can terminate now if we are satisfied that the parents are unfit by reason of conduct or condition seriously detrimental to the child. And that's all the law says. We're asking you to put some guidelines to control under what conditions we can terminate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move it out.
We have a motion before setting a motion. Well, I'll accept the way it is. Does any of the members on the committee have any questions for this?
I'm going to hate to fight this on the floor, and I've got a pretty good record, you know, this year. I'll probably lose it.
Tom, I make one commitment to you. Whether this bill passes or not, the next time there is a case involving termination, you should be appointed to defend the parents.
There you are.
Clerk, call the roll on Senator Minger's motion. House Bill 2797, vote to forward to do that.
Senator Howard.
Aye.
Senator Mahoney.
No.
Senator Minger.
Aye.
Senator Ripper.
Aye.
Senator Clark.
Aye. That bill goes out with a due pass recommendation, and the rest of the show is
And does the record show that Senator Mahoney will vote no?
Yeah, we have that already.
Tom, no hard feelings.
You know, thank you very much.
Like I say, if you were the only gentleman in this,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And appreciate you. I wish you would leave us
I'm a better legislator and a judge than I am a typist, but it's 12 o'clock last night.
I know, we're having the other time. And I very appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'll probably be up in about 2 weeks, Your Honor, before you. I hope I'm on the right side.
Well, I'm going to comment on
before getting into our large bill, you have to wait meetings for the bill. Before getting into the large bill, we have a very particular bill this morning, and I'll explain it to you. During this session of the legislature, we've had nothing but wine bills and bottle bills and all kinds of that type of bills. We spent more time looking at the bottles than we have looking at taxes sometimes. And we have a bill before this committee, and explain it briefly to you. This, when the bottle bill was enacted, those people who received their refund from bottlers had to be consumers. And this bill, we call it the mini bottle bill, this bill changes that so that those kids who pick up bottles or anybody who collects that stuff can go to the store and get their refund. This is I think is one in the must line. Would anybody have any objection? That's probably the most important bottle bill this committee will probably get out. It deals with
that. Send it out.
I support that. My grandson picked up bottles.
But I understand he had to pay you half of it. Would you have any objection to that?
No, just give me an opportunity to vote for a bottle bill.
Okay, it'll be the first time voted for. And we'll pass that one out. And then I would advise the committee this morning that in last night's procedure, there was a bill that was voted on last night, and actually the bill was in the possession, but not legally or something, and there was a follow-up bill. So that bill is going to be sent back to this committee today, and we're going to have to take it back out. So if you've got a follow-up committee, I will have a report ready to send that one back out. All right. Now we have...
What time was that?
29. Anyway. 29. We haven't started yet.
What, the bottle bill?
Oh, the bottle bill, yeah. 3278. All right. Now this morning, gentlemen, I do know that we'll only have a quorum here for just a few minutes, but we have had assigned to us House Bill 2652. I mean, what that is.
A little housekeeping thing. 2652.
This is a bill that comes to us quite late in the session. There seems to be a lot of people very much concerned with the bill. And so what we would like to do this morning, I guarantee that President is telling me that I'll get to work on it as soon as we possibly could. And I think there is a lot of work to be done on this bill. And so what we will do, we're going to give the proponents of this bill 15 minutes or up to that point, and the opponents, probably 15 minutes, so this committee has to adjourn at 7:30. So, 8:30, excuse me. So I would like to take the proponent first. Now, the first person to signed up here to speak for the bill is Kent Cannon. And Kent, if you would like to, now there's 9 people signed up for the bill. And you're going to have to divide your time. If you can be the spokesman, the main spokesman, fine. And if not, we'll have to take more time later on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2652 is a bill that merges the Fish and Game Commission, puts the two commissions into a new Department of Fish and Wildlife with a 7-member commission appointed by the governor. This type of legislation has a long history before this legislature. I'm sure the senators are well aware. At least 7 interim committees of the legislature have approved this type of legislation. The first proposal came in 1948. When Dr. Ira Gabrielson came out as a consultant to the legislature and urged the joining of the Fish and Game Commission. I was a member of an interim committee in 1963, 64, and so on that also looked at this particular problem and urged the joining of the two. We brought Mr. Tom Kimball out, who now is the executive head of the National Wildlife Federation. Mr. Chairman, this bill was carefully drafted. It's very well written, we feel. The two commissions, as well as the interested citizen groups, have had an opportunity over a period of long months to work with the drafting and with the finalizing of the bill and bringing it before the legislature. For the first time in the history of this type of legislation, I think both the Fish Commission and the Game Commission, as well as the major citizen groups that are interested in the fish and game resources of the state, are behind this type of legislation and have supported it, and did so testify at numerous occasions before the House as well as before the Ways and Means Committee. Rather than take additional time, Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring the commission, both of them are here, as well as members of citizen conservation groups, and have them also assure the committee of their interest and their support for House Bill 2652. We hope that the committee would give favorable consideration to it. I think you'll find next on your list the Game Commission you signed up with Mr. John McKean, who is director of the commission, and Mr. Alan Kelly, who is a member of the commission. And I would like to have them come forward now.
Okay. That's fine. John, would you put another chair up there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John McKean, the director of the Game Commission. I'm fortunate to have with me today Mr. Alan Kelly, a member of the commission, and we'd like to start off by Mr. Kelly giving you his viewpoints as a commissioner and the impact this is going to have on the job of being a commissioner and the job of making the policy decisions that the law requires.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I've been on the Game Commission for 2 years, having been appointed by Governor McCall 2 years ago this July. I believe I can speak on this subject of a commissioner's function and attitudes under a bill such as the one proposed. We have given this at the commission level considerable study since last July. We were most critical of the original draft of this bill. We made numerous recommendations. Our input was accepted. And ultimately, a bill was devised here that we consider is good legislation. The opposition to this bill is very much centered with the commercial fishing industry. This is the base opposition as I know it. Some of the criticisms against the bill have been this: the lack of objectivity of the commissioner, the 7 commissioners that will comprise the joint commission. If this bill becomes law, there will be 4 current game commissioners and three fish commissioners, a total of seven, as one of our terms is expiring on July 20th. I'd like to speak about this objectivity of commissioners. It has been indicated that the game commissioners particularly would be subject to tremendous pressure from the sport fishing interest. However, the bill is drawn with specific directives in it, which certainly defines our responsibilities very clearly, and I cannot see where you will have commissioners that will not accept their responsibilities in an objective manner. I'd like to recite another content of this bill as it would relate to game commissioners or fish commissioners. The present game code really gives it all to a game commissioner. He cannot be removed without misconduct, as I recall it. He is entitled to hearing. He also is entitled to legal counsel. The current bill reads differently. It states that a commissioner can be removed for cause. The interpretation of cause, as I see it, is much tighter than the present game code. Now, I would relate this to game commissioners in respect to not being objective or fish commissioners. I believe the current bill could take care of this thing if commissioners were not functioning in a proper manner for their state. Historically, these consolidation bills and home administrative bills that have been introduced have reached a certain point, and then there have been major amendments submitted to these bills. These amendments have been submitted to gain user advantage, and ultimately it has been led to the defeat of the measure. I trust that there would be no amendments to this bill and that it could be considered in its present status. I know that we commissioners would approach our responsibilities in a manner in which is expected by the people of Oregon if this 2652 becomes law. Time is running out, or possibly I should say hours, gentlemen, on this particular bill as you're approaching adjournment. And we on the Oregon State Game Commission respectfully ask your prompt and affirmative consideration of this measure. Thank you. Mr. McKean,
Chairman, I'd like to say just a few words about the benefits that are to be derived in the matter of administration of the laws and programs that are dictated by the legislature and the commission. Dr. Cruz and I and our respective staff have worked real hard at the job of trying to coordinate our efforts to do the best job of what we can of managing common resources that we're both involved in. We find there are limits to how far we can go because of the different statutes we operate under and the provincialism that goes with two different agencies. Examples are that we have administratively identical shops, business management, engineering, I&E, biology, all of these things, expertise. Each of us have to maintain separate departments in order to carry off the dictates of the legislature. We see here an opportunity to make substantial savings or improve in performance by better coordination and single administration of our community programs.
Why would it be saved?
I say savings, I think that we would be, could be more efficient. And accomplish more for a dollar spent.
This money,
we think that the same number of people could do more work and provide better service for the resources and the people in service. Early in our discussion of this matter and in our study of this matter, Gene and I appointed a joint committee of staff members to work at the problem of identifying problems, benefits, and developing a potential organizational structure for such a new agency if it was developed. Our staff did this. They identified many opportunities to enhance performance, and we come up with a proposal which may or may not be acceptable to the commission, but would provide for a decentralized statewide organization that I'm confident would make better use of the facilities and resources that are available to us for development of the fish and wildlife resource. One of the main things that I see as a benefit in this is the current push for land and water use planning. And the major role that these both of our agencies have in providing information to the county, a tremendous workload of assembling data and presenting this data to all the groups that are going to be involved in land and water use planning. So I think a single agency can do this job much more effectively than we can ever hope to do it as separate agencies. So basically, I'm telling you that in my judgment, we could perform the job you've given us much more efficiently as a single agency than we can as two agencies. I think, Mr. Chairman, that's it.
I'm glad for the questions that you have. I'd like to call Mr. Moorhead, or Moorhead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm George Moorhead. I've been called for a lot of I'm president of the Oregon Wildlife Federation, an independent organization whose primary concern is in preservation and proper use of the resources of the state of Oregon. And our federation consists of a number, approximately 30 clubs and a number of individual members all over the state of Oregon. And we have gone on record as favoring this legislation as it is, has been presently presented. I don't want to take any more of your time. Our statements have been made before other committees, and I'm sorry that our executive director is in bed with a flu and can't make a more fluent statement than I can, but Senator Howard has heard him.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gene Cruz, State District Director. We have the same opportunities the Game Commission did to review the draft bill that the Governor's Office prepared. We were able to work with the Governor's Office following that review, and changes that we suggested to them were approved, and the bill was acceptable to us. The Commission met and unanimously endorsed the major bill. We see the major benefits as being in a couple of particular areas. One is this area that John mentioned of being able to more efficiently handle the responsibilities of managing the fish and wildlife resources of the state. The other is resolving or at least having a single agency that has the authority to resolve the constant annual user interest conflict that we have on the Sun River Dam. At the present time, the statutes do not permit us to effectively look at both sides of the picture when we make decisions. And we think that if we were able to do this, we could perhaps shortstop some of the problems that continue to come down to the legislature in the sessions that we have. The last area would be in the area of people planning. We could look down the road together. What we need in the various species, where they need to be placed, and what's going to be the greatest benefit to the future state, and be a far better position than either for a single agency or a separate agency with two different responsibilities. So we endorse the merger and there's your favorable consideration.
Haley?
lady chairman's organization, the Isaac Walton League, you have our statement, so I'll just hit a couple of high points. We have supported the idea of merger for a long time, and but there's been since trying to get a bill that was acceptable and all, and we've been working with the legislative people and the governor's office, legal counsel, since November on this. They've made several amendments, and we are thoroughly in agreement with the bill as it now stands. We, if it were re-amended, that might change our stance. We believe that there can be a strong increase in eliminating the duplication administration and the management of the resources for the benefit of the whole state. We have no quarrels with the present management of either the Fish Commission or the Game Commission. And they have been managing for their respective groups, the group that has their user pressure, as you might say. Under this, I think the management will become more for the people of the state. And as the bill is now written, I think it has the safeguards that we as sportsmen would like to see in it. And we strongly urge your support of the bill as it is now written. Thank you, gentlemen.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, sir. Mr. Rancourt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Randy Rancourt from Portland. I represent the Momoa Anglican Hunters Club as their legislative chairman. Also, I've been authorized to speak for two other greater Portland area clubs, the Western Rod and Reel and the Milwaukee Rod and Gun. In previous sessions, we have opposed merger bills because of the content of the wording in the bills. But in House Bill 2652, we find that the protection afforded the members of the commission, as spelled out on page 5, lines 18 and 19, is compatible with the cause that we have espoused over the years. We feel that the merger of the two commissions will definitely result in doing away with some of the duplication overlapping of efforts, and thereby be beneficial to the resource and the people of Oregon. Where the bill is well written, the separation of the money from the game fund and the commercial fund are spelled out so that the sportsmen cannot say that their money is going to support the commercial fishery. We feel that as written, without amendment, we certainly we urge a due pass recommendation from this committee.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I first heard of this plan. First year I came up here, it was 1939. I may be wrong, maybe it was 41. It's kind of funny. But this is the part of it that still comes up.
Yes, it does, Senator.
You know, we need Chinese good news to it.
We all agree this time.
First time the commission's ever supported.
First time they've offered on anything.
What do you mean, Norm?
All the station, the sportsmen.
Oh, I mean everybody is in favor of
it. Wonderful. All but
wonderful.
any questions? No,
thank you.
Now, is there anybody else here who wants to talk in favor of this bill? Okay, sir. Can you give us your name and who you represent, please?
My name is Chuck Foss. I represent the Northwest Steelheaders Council of Scott Unlimited.
A what now?
A Northwest Steelheaders Council of Scott Unlimited.
Okay, and how many people are in that organization?
There are 6,000 in the organization,
and
of which 38.
Do you represent all of them?
Yes, sir.
What authority do you represent?
I represent it by what Walt McGovern, who is the state president of the organization.
Who
could not make it this morning.
Well, I just feel the rest of the absolutely clear. The members in your organization have voted, or is it through executive session? How do you receive your authority to do that?
Yes, sir. A month and a half ago, we had a president's meeting where all presidents from the entire Pacific Northwest met at the Airfield Motel.
How many Portland. People was that?
I think there's about 70 people
represented
all the
representing how many altogether?
6,000 of them.
6,000.
That's just the
president. So 70 people made the decision for 6,000.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's all I want.
Very good. I will say very briefly that we concur, along with the Oregon Wildlife Federation, the Isaac Walton League, mm-hmm. and with the Fish Commission and the Game Commission. We feel, if I may say just one thing, and that is that our organization is dedicated to the protection and enhancement of fisheries. I don't think that the Northwest Steelheaders stand here before you agreeing with this, predicated on the fact that we're interested in the sportsmen over the commercial industry. We feel that this will provide wide fish management, and in particularly in the Navajo Fish Division. We think it's time that those two agencies are put together so that the wisest and Navajo Fish Management. We think that Joe will do it.
You think the management in the past has not been good?
Well, sir, I think it's been good. There's expertise in both agencies, but I think that there are pressures on both sides, and they work against each other. And I think that if it was one under one agency, that it would certainly help the fish and the fisheries. You see, the problem that the way I see it, there are several stocks of an abdomen fish. There are spring chinook, fall chinook, early winter chinook, and one agency is responsible for one area, another agency is responsible for another area. And I think if we had this agency together, and it's worked in other states, certainly, where the anadromous fish division is under one system, one expertise system. For instance, it determines at this particular point whether steelhead or coho or chinook go into a particular river system or stream to use a particular water source. I think it could be determined by this new agency.
How would they do it now?
Well, sir, I can only give you my opinion.
You don't know how to do it.
Well, yes, I do it.
Okay.
Certainly, it's for sure. Anything that is native to that water comes first. If it takes an increase in production in that water, certainly they will choose which fish or which species is going to be best for that water.
And I'm just trying to find out now. How would it change if this organization decides differently where that fish is going to go if it goes there now?
Well, I think that if we take a particular area, such as above Bonneville, all the way back to St. Catherine Creek on the Grand Round, at that particular area, and several other creeks in that area, we think that rather than perhaps maybe coho, which is after it leaves the marine area in the salt water and comes into the Columbia River water course, it's a very, very difficult fish for sportsmen to catch. Now, on the other hand, if perhaps maybe spring chinook went into that area, well, there's a chance for the commercial fishermen to obtain that fish below Bonneville. There's an opportunity for the commercial Indian fish to be above Bonneville for that fish. And then when it comes into the freshwater course, the sportsmen have an opportunity all the way to the Columbia River and into that tributary. But I think if both agencies were together, they could have the opportunity to sit down and discuss this thing and find out which species is perhaps maybe best suited and perhaps which is best suited for the people of the state of Oregon.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Does anybody else there that wants to do it? All right. Now, we'll take those who are here voicing their opinion.
I thought earlier everybody was in there.
Well, one.
Well, I'm going to ask Mr. Dugas if he would come up, please.
Mr. Chairman, yes, this is saving time. Can I ask Mr. Lance to share the
chair
with me?
Sure.
I think we won't love
him. Sure.
Thanks to the people. Now, it's time for your other meeting. Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, I'm Ted Bugis, the Executive Secretary of the Columbia River Salmon and Tuna Packers Association, a nonprofit and organization in the state. And I'm authorized today to also oppose this bill on behalf of the Columbia River Fishermen's Protected Union, all the gillnet fishermen in the Columbia River, and also the West Coast Trollers Association, and also the Oregon Otter Trawl Commission. These are all the commercial interests in this bill, and although we're represented only by myself and Mr. Lansing. And I must apologize for preempting Mr. Lansing. I know he's a lobbyist down here, but I have a little more mileage on me, and I've got through some of the other bills that some of the senators have brought up, and I want to discuss those just briefly for the committee's benefit. First of all, let me say that one of the difficult problems that confronts the commercial industry every year when they face bills such as this and a number of others that have been presented to this legislative body this year is that everybody says, well, just give a little this year and you buy peace. Now, there isn't a soul in this room, except Mr. Voss, the last gentleman who testified, that we can't get along with. Now, Mr. Voss isn't even a problem personally.
but his organization, Steelheaders, have clarified their record at such a point, and they want to end the commercial industry in the Columbia River, but it just isn't fair to say that we can live with those folks. They want us out, and we have to defend ourselves. Now, this is the name of the game. This is another effort to do indirectly what hasn't been done by a whole handful of other bills in this session. It isn't that the commercial folks haven't made concessions. There are a number of them in bills that are actually going to pass this session, 409 is one. The complete renovation of the Fish Commission's budget by tremendous increase, percentage-wise, of all the fees and licenses. It's kind of changed the approach of justifying all that's been done in the general fund in sort of a dedicated way. Somewhat similar to, but not statutorily, similar to the dedicated fund that funds the Game Commission. We're not afraid of the Game Commission per se. We are afraid of the governor. He's cleared the record, as has his governor before him, that on certain cases when the heat gets tough and the system, he'll cave. Now I could cite the chapter and verse, and let me just say in one case, 2 years ago, when the Fish Commission decided there was enough fish, we ought to do it early in the fall, in the winter, where there's a very controversial fishery, all the scientific data pointed to it, the governor tried to get the commission to change its position, and he refused. There's no justification on the basis of the scientific data for our not taking a few thousand fish. We did not harm the run. We are never going to harm the run when it exists in situation because the commission has such tremendous powers. And we shouldn't harm the run. But under this bill, you will have a situation where, and incidentally, I'll point out some technical flaws in the actual bill and offer some amendments, whereby the governor will, in essence, through this commission, have absolute control of what we do, and it will not necessarily be based upon the needs of the region. Pardon me?
So the governor has absolute control, you mean, under this?
Under this proposed legislation, yes. Now, the way he would do that would not be immediately as a result of this bill, but eventually by virtue of the appointments of the commissioners and the control of who he appoints. We would not be afraid of consolidation, and the amendments we offer actually provide for a consolidation. But they provide for a separate management of an enagement and a food fish, group of fish, and then a separate management under the game fish of the game fish and game animals and birds. Much, in fact, is patterned completely after the 1963 version of the bill was passed in House in this body of this legislature. But let me say this. I want to go back and point out I'm not picking on a governor particularly. Senator, now Senator Hatfield, fell victim to the same pressure, and it's tough. When the politics and the numbers of people who are writing and saying we don't want this decision, this commission gets so intense, they cave, the best of them do. So I'm not picking on Senator McCaul, although we've picked on our senator in regard to this bill lately. Let me say that we can't live under this bill as we now live. Let me say that our offered amendments will make a situation under which we think we can live. And let me point out to begin with two major flaws which exist under the engrossed version. This is the latest one you have before you, which apparently the governor's people and the agencies haven't reviewed very well. Because on page 5, you have two different sizes of the new commission. On section 6, paragraph 1, there's a 7-man commission. And paragraph 2, which is an amendment made over in the
it's
on page 5, Senator. Section 6, paragraph 1 and 2. Paragraph 1 provides for a 7-man commission, which is, I guess, still the desire of the governor. But paragraph 2 provides for a 5-man membership, comprised of somebody appointed from each of the congressional districts and one at large. Now, we frankly prefer the latter, but I think you've got some problems with the election indicative of some of the problems we've found. There's another flaw, which is a flaw only insofar as it has a tendency to injure the commercial industry,
on page 3 at the bottom of the line, at the bottom of the page, in section 4, paragraph 1, where it defines food safety. And it tells what food fish can be taken under commercial means. And it says food fish means all the fish except those defined above under game fish under section 3, and shellfish and so forth. Well, then when you go back to the definition under the section 3, you find listed salmon steelhead, I mean, steelhead trout, which is a true trout, but which we take incidental to some other commercial salmon fishing because the trout fish intermingled with this coho, with that heavy run of coho in the fall. And if we are completely eliminated, completely stopped in our possibility to even incidentally take those, as seems to be the case with this whole bill, we are in real trouble because we have fantastic economic waste of coho and false enough in the fall. I don't know whether that was intentional or drafters, but I've got my suspicions it might have been. Now, I'll quickly go, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, to our suggested amendment. And I've printed a copy.
Before we go on there, oh, never mind. That's good. All right.
You see my point in there. I'm going rather fast. If there's any point I'm trying to make that becomes confusing, you have to excuse my interruption. Let me, I've furnished, and in the interest of time, it's been difficult, but I've furnished, in essence, remodeled the bill totally with the 1963 version of the bill, and even it requires some changing, and frankly, gentlemen, if you pass this bill out with my amendments, it will require considerable consultation of myself and another member of the Senate, Senator Holmstrom, with the Legislative Council in order to draft it properly according to the intent, but I think the intent is clear. What we suggest is this, a five-man commission in this set of amendments. A five-man commission comprised of one person from each of the congressional districts and one at large, as paragraph 2 in section 6. And we suggest that this commission, this is a true combination of the commission, we suggest then that this commission appoint a head of a bureau or a department of food safety and one of game fish and animals, and you keep your division or your management roughly as it is. Now, in essence, this would keep the big game people happy, in my judgment. The big game people are now critical of the commission for spending too much big game, too much of what they consider to be the big game fraction of the food and nitrogen on fish, because you have the fish commission doing some big pertaining reproduction. Now, the powers of the commission would be to hire these two directors to direct their activity and have policy-making stature as they now do. It would be removable only for cause, which is the case under the proposed Bill 2662. And this would allow the equivalent of the present game director to manage, propagate, set feeders, and so forth on all game license users, whatever fish they take under care. It would not change or designate or try to designate as game fish or food fish any particular fish because that's ridiculous. This is one of our problems now. Users have a tendency to say those fish are ours or these fish are yours. Can't be done. It would allow also the equivalent of the present fish director to be responsible for the propagation, handling, and management of all commercial fishes of the fish designated as commercial or food fish, and would not extend his purview into the game area whatsoever, except in the reproduction of all anadromous species, including steelhead. Now, this makes sense because they have the greatest quantity of the hatchery responsibility. Now, it would be with some of the duplication that you've heard about here, but not identified, and it would, in our judgment, provide for a true merger and yet divided management, which we feel you must have because you have a divided type of funding. You have a dedicated funding to sports teams, and we don't want to touch that. The commercial contrary to what anybody may think or have said, we do not want to touch that as dedicated fund, and we can't touch it, and we never should have the power to do that. But this would allow for the dual management and yet eliminate some of the duplication of that. Now, one other thing, and
I would stop, Mr. Chairman. We've heard a lot about the unfortunate duplication of potential or alleged savings that emerges such as this bill would suggest. And I can say only that where there is any conflict, the statute now very clearly at 506.123 provides for arbitration, and then I'm quoting from the statute, arbitration policies of commission, semicolon, rules of procedure. In case of any policy conflict between the commission and the state games commission, this is in the commercial code, the state games commission, the governor or a person designated by him shall act as arbiter. Close quote. And we'll end that segment. Now, this has never been used, or hardly at all, I don't think at all, in my knowledge, in this case, but the mechanism here to avoid this duplication now. There's no reason these two agencies can't combine and then purchase and a few other things. Now, is there anything in the law of this state that provides that you must duplicate activities that are protected and made? I don't know of any. So the allegation that this is the only vehicle by which we can save tremendous amounts of unspecified dollars just doesn't hold water. Mr. Chairman, we can't live, we feel, under this because it's attempting to be indirectly what a number of people have tried to do directly, that is, eliminate the commercial industry either by step or immediately. And we urge that you accept the amendments we have submitted to you, and I'll be very happy to work with you or any member of the Legislative Council in order to perfect them, because I admit they are not clean in every respect at this point, because we've had not enough time to do so.
Any questions from anyone? Senator Howard has it.
Ted, were these offered over, amendments offered over the House?
No, sir.
Why not?
We just tried to defeat the deal. We did not think we'd get this far in the room to say it's our last effort and our last chance to offer amendments.
Right, it's pretty close, sir.
I feel unfair and dishonest if I didn't tell you that these amendments I do not believe are going to be accepted. It's been reported to service. I don't know if we'll have a chance to bat again, so I'll speak for them.
Yeah,
Senator
Newby,
the thing in this bill that particularly concerns you is in Section 4, where food safety is defined as being anything except a green
bean. What section is that, man?
Page 3, Tom. Section 4 is down at the bottom of the page, where it says food safety means all fish except those defined as game fish, which would, in your judgment, ruin the incidental catch feature that you currently enjoy. Isn't that right? I've felt for a long time, I've supported mergers for a long time. Madeline and I worked on it, and that goes back quite a ways. Not as far as Senator Mahoney, but far enough. But the thing we have here, and we've had for since 1939, and perhaps even before, is conflict of interest between two groups. And if in each group, I can remember when the game commission was favorable to a merger and the sports people were unfavorable to it. And the reason for that was that the language in the bill was couched in such terms as they sportsmen felt that the game people or the fish commission people had the advantage. Now we're faced with this circumstance where the fish commission, the commercial fishermen, feels the sportsman has an advantage. Now, there ought to be a mechanism whereby I think the real area of contention in the Columbia River, is it not? The balance of the fishery is of no major concern to commercial people.
Well, I think that that's true largely, but not entirely. I think there is some conflict in the coal areas in the oceans area. One of the hot kitchen incidents I referred to actually had to do with the triangle down at the Sensoristic District, where there was conflict between sports and commercial coaling out in the nation.
Well, the point I was getting at is this. It seems to me like what we ought to have is a method whereby contentions could be adjudicated. Now, I'm thinking of a situation that has come to my attention where the there was a run, and the commercial fishermen were precluded from fishing in that run because of various concerns. And yet, when the fish got to the end of the run, the game commission was digging trenches and burying the fish. Now, this is wasteful to everybody. It's of no value to the game commission or to the sports fishermen or the people of the state of Oregon to have unharvested fish just being buried because there's no place else they can go. The thing that occurs to me is that there ought to be a way whereby somebody in a judicial capacity could make determinations on the basis of facts and be untouchable. And I agree with what you say about the governor. I cost the last Democratic governor we had his job because he got to dicking around in game and closed the hunting season, and that's a powerful group. You take sports fishermen and hunters, and when they get together, boy, it's tough. And if we had a mechanism, and it's too late in the session to do it now, whereby we could establish somebody, when decisions are made, an appeal is made from those decisions where the facts could be brought and a determination on the basis of facts, then I think a merger would work. Until that time, I think that somebody's going to have an advantage. If it isn't the commercial fisherman, as in preceding bills, it's going to be the sports fisherman, as in perhaps this bill. I don't know how you went on that. I've got a lot of letters about this matter of all these fish bills, and one that impressed me tremendously came from a little old lady in Portland. She said that she enjoyed eating salmon, and if there is no commercial catch, where does she get it? And that's a good question. She can go out of fish. So I'm not for destroying the commercial catch by damn sight.
Well, then you think that the fill or that the thing that is in the foreseeable future is possible is merger. If a bill. Proper bill would buy in. Do you think that sometime there will be a merger?
Well, I would hope so, Tom, and I'll tell you why. We got two fish hatcheries that are sitting right side by each someplace. I don't know where they are. And that's ridiculous. There's a place where the same personnel could run both hatcheries, and I think everybody would agree. There's one place. And there may be others. I don't know. But there's always going to be this conflict of interest. There can't help it. The sports fishermen are going to claim that the gill netters and the trollers are just destroying the resource. And at the same time, the commercial fishermen are going to say, well, by gosh, these guys are not catching the fish and they're wasting at the upper end of the river. If we had a mechanism whereby these biologists, and these biologists are pretty daggone sharp, they can pretty much tell. And if you could divorce the emotion from the issue someplace for adjudication, I think maybe it would work. I don't know. But you'd have to be in a court, I think, and it would take a unique court because certainly some of the judges, I think, might be biased one way or another. Maybe King Lewis would be a good one.
I don't think any court would work because you watch the fish that go over Bonnyville Dam, and I don't. One time there was one year with one breed of fish, or I guess that's what they are, a breed, they, there'll be very few go over that dam. And then the next year, holy smoke, like they just got done with some kind of fish going that dam up there, all the way up into Idaho. They really come over the fish. It takes something like that. Well, the fish commission can't do it. They set the days, and if there isn't enough time to go over Bonneville, then they order the nets out or limit the nets. With the two of them working together, I think they can. I know that
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the reason it can't work together is because the clientele, the sports clientele, won't permit the sports representatives on the commission to deal with the thing in an attitude of objectivity. Let me illustrate the last season that we endured. The last season, this is ancient history, in May, we had a hearing. In April, we had a hearing. Two of them, as a matter of fact. It was a testimony, almost unanimously, of the sports fraternity, not quite unanimously, but almost, that run would not sustain a commercial fishery because the sportsmen were out there and they couldn't catch fish. The test fishing showed that there was a big run in the river. The count over the dam was skyrocketing. You talk about a court, our fish commission, and I always get in trouble because I pat them on the back, and everybody says we own them when they get out of the room like this. I mean, all the sports people are attacking. They had guts. They said, look, all the indicators show us that there's some fish in the river, go fishing. It's the second best in the last decade or so. But yet, every one of the sports fraternities said, no, we can't catch them, they aren't there. The dam counts are erroneous. Something's wrong. Of course something's wrong. We had a low river and fast transportation, fast moving of the fish. Just such a court exists in the Oregon Fish Commission. You combine them and split their clientele and put a whole bunch of constituents on their back, and they can't let us go fishing. I don't give a darn if there's 10 times that.
Well,
and that's our problem.
Now, Ted, this is, I readily agree with you that the sport fishermen are overboard too, but the commercial fishermen are just as overboard. This is where
How so, sir? Where have we decimated the run? Where have we overfished it?
Don't overfish it. None of you are ever cooperating and trying to agree on something. But when you get trapped like you were up in agriculture, then you're willing to do it. Now you offer amendments the last day of the session because you didn't think the bill was going to get this far. If you thought that there was anything to a merger, you should have been offering it to over in the House. But you readily admitted that you didn't think it was going to get this far. Now it's got this far, you're ready to compromise. And this is the way legislation should operate. I mean, we should try to come to some agreement. Perhaps your amendments could have been accepted in the House. But here we are in the 175th day of the session. We've got almost all sides agreeable besides the commercial. And each year we end up this way. So I say it is a merger of the fishing
business. I would like to point out that right now there does exist a vehicle whereby the Fish Commission must recognize the recreational user that passed both the House and Senate in vehicle Senate Bill 409. So they are, at this time, as soon as the governor signs the bill, they will be directed to attend to both sides of the fence, as Dean Cruz mentioned, at this time they did not. As soon as the governor signs it, they should offer a vehicle to somewhat quell some of this conflict. But as the senator does point out, as far as compromise, we have been compromised throughout the years, and this bill is offensive to us in its present form, and now we're pushed in a corner that it's necessary for us to compromise to keep our head above water.
Come on, don't you agree with the statement that the government is going materially inconsistent, one way or the other?
Not one of the two commissions are working together.
No, I'm talking about the bill.
Well, that's what it does. That's what makes them work together. That's what the bill does.
Let's take it easy. Let's see if you have a pair of two sections of this are inconsistent.
Well, they work together and I think they could come up with an answer. Now, the Fish Commission never before has had to look at recreational aspects. These have that. That's and I think that will be a big improvement. I think that should have been there all the time. But I do think when we get something where we can, you know, everybody wants us to save money. But
this will not save money. I think the switchover costs are going to be great. I don't feel that it's really going to alleviate that much duplication. There are some areas in the Fish Commission whereby they contract out for extra personnel to complete some programs.
Well, I think they both do, but a merger is, that's the theory of a merger is it's going to save money, and we made other mergers. We just put all the highway commissions together. Department of Transportation is supposed to save money. So this is the theory that...
Senator Howard, in the floor debate on the House of Representatives, on the floor, Roger Martin did point out, and it's in the record, that this will probably not save money. In his opinion, he would hope that a merger would dictate more money going to this giant commission.
Well, that would be all right, too. If they spend more, if they spend the money to develop a
contradictory.
Is there any further comments from anybody on the committee? My comment is that I feel that here in the last days of the session, and in 6 months working on a bill on the House, and we dumped this in our lap this morning when we're looking for adjournment tonight, is not giving the Senate a very damn good run at a bill of this importance. Is what I'm thinking about. And if this bill, if there are sections that have been pointed out that is inconsistent, I think that we would be very well criticized and justly so if we passed a bill here that wasn't in order. We send a bill to the floor and then we get it back in another 10 minutes. I would want the bill in a legal order. And if there is an inconsistency on Section 6 versus paragraph 2 and paragraph 1, I think these things should be taken care of. And after 6 months, if those people haven't seen it, and for somebody to get up here and say we shouldn't amend the bill, the Senate's got every right in the world to amend any bill. That's what we're here for. That's our duty. And I'm not saying I'm bowing to the will of nobody. I'm going to send a bill out of here that's the right kind of a bill that meets the Legislative Council's wording, and we're going to leave this will be right, because I'm not going to have it leave here and be criticized for acting quickly on something we haven't had a chance to work at. And so I just wanted to make that abundantly clear to everybody, so that I want to be absolutely fair to both sides, but I'm not going to send out something that isn't in order. We just won't recognize that. Is there any questions further than anybody on the committee and what we're going to have to do? I'm not going to hesitate to take a look at the amendments that were presented to us. And I think what I would do, I think I would like to take a little time this morning and let Legislative Council explain to us what is involved here, so that when we send a bill out, we have a bill that we can say, this comes from this committee with our recommendation. Now, I said my part. Now, if any member on the committee disagrees with me, it's fine.
I agree that we're at an unfair disadvantage here. We've either got to accept the package that came to us late, or just not have a bill. And that's a bad decision to put the Senate in. I agree with that.
But these articles that are in this bill that have been pointed out to us, I'm going to find out about it so that we know what we're talking about anyway.
Well, I know one thing, Mr. Chairman. I hit my check to have to explain this bill on the floor with even glaring inconsistencies, regardless of what I thought about the merits of the bill.
Well, I do know we've run over our time.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The only thing I can say is, finally, if you do pass the bill, I strongly recommend you talk to the Legislative Council and sponsor the bill. It's technically incorrect. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Our time is run over, gentlemen.
these out.
In such a time.
Check these out and see where we stand, because I I'm not going to be in a position of having to send this order and get it back in 10 minutes. I want to, when we send it up there, I want to be in a position so I figure it's going to pass.
I think in fairness to the sports fishermen, they ought to have a copy of the amendment that was proposed.
We will get something put off, and so the sports fishermen can have you got copies of the amendment?
No, sir, you're the only one that has copies. I have just have that.
All right.
There are three copies in here. You have two.
Our staff here is going to be extremely busy today because he jumped on us a whole flock of those that we haven't even had a chance to look at, and we're going to be working at them also.
I'll give McKean my copy.
Okay, then let's see. It's an old one, we have some problems. Okay, and I'll have to call, we'll have to check the time, gentlemen, where we've got a little space up there, and we will, you be thinking of how you, what you want to do on this, and I'm going to check with those sections that Mr. Gibbons has mentioned here. I'll be checking with John and the rest of them. But if we pass, though, I'm going to build it. This is going to be brought back in our favor.
Let us look.
Okay.
Senator, I ask a question.
It's your turn.
You considering cleaning up this bill, or are you considering putting in all the new amendments?
We'll have to take a look at them, sir. This morning is the first time we've been here. And we're going to take that broadly to look at it.
Than I have on this subject. Much of it is forewarned. Mostly Senator Mahoney, there's some people who are terribly concerned about sports fishing. I'm concerned about it too. Because I just don't act that way. They're citizens, and I'm a sports fisherman. I love to eat. Members of this committee, many of you, know that I'd rather fish than eat, and often have. And I fish with most of you, and you know my dedication to it. But I think that we can come up with a program that will redound to the good of the state of Oregon. There comes a time when we must make these tough decisions. And so I would recommend to you, Mr. Chairman, that if you can, and the committee can agree, that it would be wise to let the Senate have a chance to vote on this bill and see if we can get this accomplished during this session of the legislature. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your courtesy and your honor to testify. And I'll be most happy to answer any questions.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. I have any questions on that? I know, Val, would you like to say, Mr. President, I think you probably might have a feeling that without working on this, that in the speed that you would require or ask us to do, we went to work on this morning at 7:30 this morning. We had some testimony that was given to us, and we checked it out, and the members of the testimony, some of the day aired in the testimony. Then I went to Legislative Council, and there's about how many. There would be eight or nine bills, or due to bills that have already passed. There's about eight or nine conflicts, and I've been trying to work them out all morning. I haven't got all those together, but those things have to be taken care of before we can send a bill out. And I'm not going to send a bill out with the idea of getting up the floor and send it right back down. And when I send it out, to get this bill out, it's got to be in first class shape.
I understand, and I appreciate that. And I would like you to know, Chairman, that I will order the full offices of the Legislative Council and their staff of attorneys to give you all aid and assistance that we can to help you in this matter. And anything that my office is able to do to help you in this, I'll be most happy to provide for the committee. Anything that you need, I'll be delighted to provide and order as a first priority.
Okay. Now, what we're saying here, too, is these amendments that will be made to take care of the conflict. We're looking at the bill as it is now. We haven't amended this bill. So we're going to take care of the conflict that's in this bill. And there are going to be quite a few of them. And so we want to have it right.
I appreciate that. And of course, we in the Senate have always prided ourselves on getting bills out that are right. And the sloppy legislation is worse than no legislation. And I appreciate your concern with the excellence of the piece of legislation. If there's anything I can do to help in this way, please.
Mr. Fireman, I was down here this morning for a 10:00 p.m. I only had 2.5 hours sleep left.
I know that. And you may get less tonight as we drive for adjournment.
Is there any questions about that? Well, thank you very much for being down here.
Thank you.
All right. And so now, Senator Carson is. Senator Carson is here on House Bill 2001.
No, 2529.
2529. Was taken from the calendar today, and an agreement was reached with the presiding officer. Myself and the other interested people in the project and the new group. And what we wanted to do here is the amendments that they have agreed upon, which is that we hope to make the bill that would be palatable to all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mahoney,
they're not in the book.
Senator Mahoney, the bill is in the book. We'll have to give you.
I can't work on a bill if I haven't seen it.
It happens back when you have time to get it.
Well, when did it pass on out?
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that was Senator was debated on the floor this morning, debated yesterday, and lost by one vote, debated again today, and sent down. It's a conflict of interest bill that we've had on our the floor of the House. It went to the
House. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, in deference to your time.
Why don't you go ahead? And then agreement has been reached, I understand, is it right, Senator Henry?
That is correct.
The amendment that you have, you've already reached an agreement on it.
That's correct. To refresh members of the committee, this was before us today on reconsideration. It was favorably reconsidered. The motion was made by Senator Newbery to send it to the committee. After discussion on the floor, it was concurred and a little question and sent to this committee. In the meantime, Senator Newbery, Senator Ripper, Mr. Steve Hawes from Legislative Council, and I spent some time refreshing our memory, making some additional changes to the amendment. We consulted with a couple other members of the Senate, and we bring before you, I think, I don't mean to speak for the other senators, but a bill that I think now has substantial agreement, at least within the legislature. The first amendment deals on line four in an attempt to resolve the concern that was raised by the American Civil Liberties Union, and I believe, in my opinion, we have resolved that.
Page four?
I've informed page four. We're taking out no public official shall language and inserting it shall be a conflict of interest.
Where is that?
Page four, Senator. Line, starting at lines 11, and then repeated again in line 15, and repeated again in line 20. The question was raised by ACLU whether or not, it was clearly our intent, not to call a conflict of interest a legislator, a member of a board, or something, but particularly a legislator who, as an educator, would have to be passing upon education laws, or a farmer passing upon farm laws, or whatever. But ACLU, I think, correctly pointed out that the interrelationship between sections 3, 4, and 5, particularly 3 and 4, and our exceptions to conflict of interest in the definition under section 2 on page 2, lines 25 and following, were not meshed well together. It was our intention, so we have now meshed them together by declaring sections 3 and 4 to be a conflict of interest, and then an exception or the definition of conflict of interest applies. I believe this solves the ACLU's problem. I don't want to indicate that they're now supporting the bill because they haven't had an opportunity to see it. The next, the amendments that appear, the first three paragraphs of your amended, the proposed amendments relate to that problem. The second problem is in section 5, beginning on line 21, and this was the problem about members of the legislature particularly, but also commissions and boards serving on boards of directors or being involved in business where they could no longer work with the state. And the example was given of a senator who was on a board of savings and loans. If he stayed on the board, they would not be able to accept state money into pocket like other savings and loans can, simply because it would be violative of this section. The problem is that the escape clause is, say, public notice and competitive bidding, where you don't publicly notice and competitively bid for putting money in a savings deposit. So we have drafted new language, and it is broader, looser in the term of what we're going in this area. It's not as tight language as Section 5, and it appears starting online in your amendments about mid-page or the first page. And the thrust of this is to make it clear that if you're involved with a business, you cannot do business with the state unless you do it with public notice and competitive bidding, with the exception of two circumstances. One, the contract of employment for personal services, which is the existing bill that allows teachers to continue to teach and so on. The second one is new and appears beginning primarily in line B, the last paragraph on the first page of the amendment. And it says the award of any contract to or the receipt of any contractual benefit by a public official or by a member of his household or by a business with which he or a member of his household is associated, if the contract is awarded or the benefit received without public notice and competitive bidding as otherwise provided by law. The effect of this, frankly, would be to allow, unless we provide otherwise by law, it would permit a public official, by definition, to serve on a board, to be connected with a business, and have that business do business with the state, unless the legislature has provided that a bidding requirement or public notice requirement is there. And we have in some areas, as this legislature, as this committee knows, we've been rather restrictive on requiring bidding for state bodies. We've also provided on the second page relating to the same element, section 6, which I think is a good provision that makes it clear that a public official, a legislative employee, may ask determination of the commission whether or not a proposed act does, in fact, conflict with interest in
violation. Public official, legislature.
Yes, sir, it does.
All right, something came up this morning, I'd say. I have to wait 60 days to get an answer. What do I do?
Well, the this is frankly dealing with a pecuniary interest aspect of it, and not strictly with a conflict of interest. And I'll, let me get an answer to this. Let's suppose it was not dealing with a pecuniary interest, but dealing strictly with a conflict of interest. And then we provided in the bill that
conflict of interest. I want to know. I want their blessing in the event I'm acting today on a conflict, might possibly a conflict of interest. What benefit is to me then?
Well,
I have to wait 60 days.
I think the answer, Senator, would be this, that on page 6, section 10, starting in line 20, that if you do in fact deem it to be a conflict of interest, then you would state publicly prior to your vote, as you and I, and I think every member of the body, has done.
Oh, yes, I know. But what benefit is this determination in any event?
Well, I see. Okay. Steve Hawes has pointed out that a public official, legislative employee, or Section 2, business with which an official or employee is associated, will not be liable under this act for any action or transaction.
I understand, but if I have to wait 60 days or any appreciable period, what benefit is it from me? I may want their advice. Does it mean anything, or is it just put in there for fun?
Well, no, it's not put in there for fun. I would hope that you would get your within 60 days.
You see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do, Senator, and I think that it's hard for me to say. I would hope that it could be immediate, but these people are going to be private citizens, and they won't be able to reach an answer that quickly. The way I think this would operate, quite frankly, is if there is a question of whether or not the state can deposit funds in Jones Savings and Loan Association, that the question be asked, and I would think that within 60 days would be a reasonable period of time. Or an independent bank, maybe I should have said that, or a U.S. national bank, or whatever it may be, that you or I or anybody else might be a member of the board. This is a new item, and it's not, I see your point, and I wish we could get immediate answers. We can't, but I think this, what the intention here is to allow the commission to make a decision on whether or not that constitutes a violation of Section 3 and 4. I'll get off that. Now, on page 5, we've moved into your committee, your special committee, subcommittee of this group. This committee made some additional changes on page 5, and this is the list of the statement of economic interest. Some concern in line 18, there's a requirement that you list your real property. And we've been all over the ballpark on this one, trying to get it to be the most convenient. The goal has been so each public official can do, as I think Senator Ripper has indicated, complete the form in a dining room table. He does not need to hire an accountant, a lawyer, fiduciary, and a bonding agent to fill out the form. So we have stricken, and I recommend striking to you, the words by legal or common description. So it would just simply read the listing of all real estate. So that if the legislator or public official wants to list it by legal description, which would be my preference, or common description, or tax law, or any means by which the property can be fairly identified, then it's his choice, and this is an amendment we propose. Then in line 3, the other major element that we spoke to on the floor, returning the bill to the way it left the Senate committee chaired by Senator Ripper, was at the end of line 23, deleting the comma, putting in a semicolon, and deleting the balance of the paragraph, so that each legislator, public official will ask you to specify the general category or source of income, whether taxable or not taxable, in excess of $500 earned received by him or a member of council during the preceding year. Not the amount. I presume I would list law practice, legislative assembly, and Oregon National Guard, and that would satisfy the requirement precisely here. Not the amount, and you would not have to put any de minimis honorarium for travel or speaking, but under $500. Then the final amendment.
How much was it?
$500. Anything above $500, you have to list the general categories: farming,
you mean
insurance, investments.
$500. I refer to one category, any single category.
Yes, sir.
Not the ag.
No, any single category.
Include the legislative expenses.
Yeah. Well, Wally, what I wanted to do, if I report that I have $50,000, I'm worth $50,000, will that be...
No, you do not report that.
Not like Jack Summers did.
No, sir.
That's fine, because I was an investigator for years, and after Jack Summers listed his earnings, if I was one of those boys, that would be the first place I'd be heading for, because he's in Salem, and he's got $350,000 in worth up in his hometown.
No, sir, this is really a declaration of where your assets are distributed, rather than the amount of them. And they may be in very small piles, or they may be in very large piles, but this will be a disclosure, because, frankly, if I may just for a moment, in my view, and I think the majority of the committee, the conflict of interest is relative. You cannot assume that to the more wealthy man, it might take more or less a degree to constitute a conflict of interest.
May I inquire what the figures to obtain from the income tax return? In other words, will one be found by what he reported on the return? Or what he actually did make?
I would expect the answer would be I don't believe the commission or anybody on the commission or working with the commission has authority to see your state or federal income tax. We deleted the requirement to report your federal or your state income tax with the bill. That's not a part of this bill. I would imagine that maybe an Internal Revenue Service investigator or auditor might want to look and see what you described here, but there are no amounts. In my view, your net worth will not be able to be determined by this disclosure. If your area is...
Well, would an investigator or anyone asking for this permission have authority to demand to see my copy of my income tax?
No, sir. No, sir. The final change in line 31, this is the question that Senator Thorne spoke to quite strongly about, and it's a new amendment in line 31.
What page?
Same page, sir, page 5. It now reads the name of each creditor to whom he or a member of his household owes or has owed during the preceding year money in excess of $5,000 and the interest rate thereon, if any. We're now zeroing in, and it will now read the name of each creditor to whom he or a member of his household owes or has owed, and we delete the balance money during the preceding year pursuant to a note, mortgage, or contract. We delete reference to a straight debt or what we were discussing, a revolving charge account or anything else in a specific amount. And quite frankly, the purpose in here is those of us that are not farm boys had explained to us is that at any given time, a farmer may have substantial debt that far exceeds $5,000 and may be to a variety of creditors, but that are paid out over a revolving line of credit. So we recommend that we don't want to be punitive in this bill, so we think we should maintain the purpose of it, and that is to disclose the general areas where notes, mortgages, or contracts are held. And so an open line of credit with a bank, you would report that. But if you owed $6,000 to Union Oil for smudge pots or for your combines or whatever it may be, you would not look like that. Now, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, the two, I think Common Cause has played a very good role in this. I bring that up because Blanche Schroeder and Bill Cross have worked very hard on this. We have talked with them and shared with them the proposed changes on the first page. I don't know that they're delighted about it, but they're not, well, I've explained those to them. Common Cause does not like, I'm told, the deletion of the categories of income of 5,000, 15, or 15 or more, and they have not had an opportunity to comment on changing the legal description and the change on the credit line. This now, I believe, has the unanimous support amendment of your subcommittee, Senator Ripper and Senator Newbery, and I wholeheartedly concur in the amendment.
Chairman, there should be one other line in the list of amendments, and that is delete line 32 on page 5.
It's just delete the 5,000, I think. Didn't we agree to leave the interest rate in?
Yeah, we did.
So delete
in
line 32, delete 4,000.
In line 32, delete. Delete quote 5,000. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate your taking me out of order.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the amendment.
I have a motion to move to adopt the amendment. Is there any objection to the amendment? We have no objection, and and most of the time, that was the main question.
I think it's been funded in the department budget.
Has it? People call me this morning, something that happened to them, but they won't be, so they can go ahead with the program.
I think we changed the bill a little bit ways and means. The effective date wasn't exactly. We just said the schools may do this.
And they claim they can't go ahead without this bill. No.
We should pass it on.
Children's services and mental health. Yeah. Would there be any objections? Well, I always can read the paper, but here.
I was looking for that change that I didn't see. I know it's been funded.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it would be the pleasure that I'll get that, but I'll get the report and I'll come around and take a look at that. And Jack, you won't have to back that one on the night. We'll do that. Now, back to the work before, I'm going to, we have to be up there right now on the floor. And I will see that legislative council will send an attorney down here to work on conflict that arise in this one bill. And as soon as I can get that together, I will be talking to the committee again. Does that make sense to you?
These are conflicts with other bills that have already passed.
If bills have already passed, so we have to take care of this bill, and then they'll have to back the concerns on that. Then I'm kind of want to speed it up. Okay, we're here. Thank you. I'm in the committee on anyway. When we got the Senate bill, or House Bill 2652, which is the bill to consolidate the game in 6 million, it came to us about as poor shape as any piece of legislation could ever arrive over here. And to make the bill legal, from just the way, if we take the bill the way it comes, we have about 8 sheets of amendments that have to be made just to make it fit in with the bills that have already passed. And we put it like that. And then council advised me this morning that he has found some more areas in here he's got to look at.
You mean the legislature?
Yeah. And so I think all we could do this morning is ask council if he would get those prepared for us, because there's no need of going after that the whole thing.
Mr. Chairman, if you want the bill to pass, these amendments that I'm talking about now, these additional ones, are technical things.
They're technical, but
we can
just the point.
What I'm saying, Senator, is we can prepare them quickly for you.
I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to vote, Mr. Chairman, on this bill or any other bill of this importance unless I know what the hell I'm voting for.
As Senator Newberry had some points that he wanted to make, he could be here this morning. Yes. And also on this bill is the emergency clause. You can vote to it.
Emergency clause.
Huh?
Well,
we'll have to put it in unless we decide
to
affect the date.
Yeah.
Just to drive us up the table.
Mm-hmm. So Senator Newberry's got some problems with it, so I think we better, I'll try to get another meeting together on it, if that makes you follow the approval, and see what Senator Newberry's said. But we have to adopt these, I know that.
All right, I'll move we adopt.
All right, we'll adopt these amendments. And get those in order, and then we'll also take a look at the Senator Newberry's amendment. Might be taken care of this emergency clause deal of effective date and that man's given it.
I don't want to vote on any amendments until I know what I'm voting for.
Okay, let's just hold them. Yeah, we'll skip the doctrine. We'll get them all together. That way we'll know what we're doing. That's just the pleasure of the committee. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We might do this, too. You will find today that we'll probably have movement on the floor that bills that have a conflict or something, bills that we've probably never looked at ourselves, that these were the only committee in operation,
that the president might have to assign some of them to us in and out in a hurry to make some technical amendments. So I'll try to keep you guys advised on this as fast as possible.
Big Deb, I'm going to have a short meeting of the Rules Committee because there's a resolution there with respect to the rules.
Okay.
Change of smoking. I promise there'll be a meeting. I've been trying ever since.
Mm-hmm.